you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is freight and carbon footprint, efforts to enhance supply chain sustainability. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Before I go any further, I do want to apologize to those of you who would have normally been getting the audio over the computer instead of the phone. Federal Highway recently changed their teleconference provider, and this is the first seminar where we're using the new provider, and we still have some kinks to work out. And unfortunately, at the last minute, I did learn that the voice over IP option wouldn't be available, but we will have that fixed in time for next month's seminar. So please bear with us. Today, you'll be hearing from three presenters: Lee Kinberg of Maersk North America, Mike Zachary of Parsons Brinckerhoff, and Diego Clabion of Northwestern University. Lee Kinberg is Environmental Director for Maersk North America, where she is responsible for environmental policies and programs, HSE compliance assurance, and pandemic flu preparedness. She is active in Business for Social Responsibility's Clean Cargo Working Group, a global group dedicated to assessing and improving the environmental impact of shipping and responsible corporate citizenship. Other recent activities included the advisory panel for the Climate Registry. Mike Zachary is a principal consultant at PB with extensive experience in global infrastructure, strategic consulting, and maritime goods movement. He is currently actively engaged in mapping freight's carbon footprint on the supply chain as an active member of TRB's Freight Planning and Logistics Committee, and of which he was the past chairman, AT015, and the impact on not only the shipper, but the regional and state-level planning organization and the associate modes of transport and distribution affected by legislation and regulatory constraints on freight as a result. Diego Clabion is an associate professor at Northwestern University, Department of Industrial Engineering and Management Sciences, and Kellogg School of Management. In 1999, he obtained his doctorate from the School of Industrial and Systems Engineering of the Georgia Institute of Technology. In the same year, he joined the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and in 2007 became an associate professor at Northwestern. He is the recipient of the first prize of the 2000 Transportation Service Science Dissertation Award. His research is focused on business intelligence and analytics related to sustainable transportation. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all of the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning listserv. If you haven't already joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is provided on the slide on your screen. Finally, I'd like to remind you that the session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and the visual portion will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next week. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have been unable to attend to access the recording. The PowerPoint presentations used today are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online, and I'll notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and a transcript. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are now eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, you must type your first and last name into the chat box. I have included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. Please also download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit this form after me after you've filled it out. In addition, even if you're not applying for AICP credits, I do encourage you to fill out the evaluation form and send it to me, as we are always looking to improve these seminars. And as I mentioned previously, we do typically offer voice over the computer, and we will have that back up and running next month. So we'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is freight and carbon footprint, efforts to enhance supply chain sustainability. Our first presenter will be Lee Kinberg of Maersk North America. As a reminder, if you have questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they'll be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. So with that, Lee, I will bring up your presentation, and you can go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Jennifer. Well, this is Lee Kinberg. I'm with Maersk Line North America, And I've been asked today to talk to you a little bit about freight and carbon footprint and some of the things that are being done to enhance supply chain sustainability. Now, just a little background on our company. Maersk Line is part of the A.P. Moller Maersk Group. It may be more familiar to some of you as Maersk Sealand. But we are part of A.P. Moller Maersk, which is headquartered in Copenhagen, Denmark, and is in shipping, energy, retail, and banking. In North America, we have U.S. flagships and international vessels, marine terminals, trucking, warehousing and distribution, and global logistics services. Now, our container shipping arm operates over 470 container vessels. We move almost 2 million containers a year.
Lee, can I just interrupt you for 1 second? I'm sorry. I'm getting a message that people are still hearing hold music. Is the operator available on the line? Yes, I'm getting notices from participants that they're still hearing hold music.
There is no hold music on the line here. Everyone is in a listen-only mode.
Okay. I have lots of people telling me that they're hearing hold music.
Okay, the music is off the line because you're on the same line that everyone else is on. The only hold music is unless they're on hold waiting for to join the conference.
Okay, so they're basically people are in line waiting to join the conference?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'll put you back in.
Lee, I'll let you go ahead and continue.
Okay. All right, well, some people are hearing us, so we'll go ahead and continue. Again, Maersk Line, which some folks know as Maersk Sealand, is our container shipping operation. We do have over 470 container vessels worldwide. Now, these containers are either 20 feet or 40 feet long. So a 40-foot container is about the size of a city bus. And 90% of all goods transported globally is done by ship. We are about 4% of worldwide shipping activities and 16% of the container segment. And those vessels consume over 10 million tons of heavy fuel oil annually, so that means our carbon footprint is well north of 30 million tons a year. So as you can see, it's something we're concerned about and working to do something about. Burning those hydrocarbon fuels does create air emissions, a lot of CO2, about 3.1 tons per ton of fuel that we burn, plus particulate matter, sulfur oxides, nitrogen oxides, black carbon, and a few other things. Now, let's step back a little bit and think about how ocean shipping works, because this is how most of these goods come into our country. If you'll look at the maps that I've shown you here, this is our Trans-Pacific 6 route. So we have vessels that leave Tanjung Pelepas, which is near Singapore, go to Hong Kong, and then over to Los Angeles. But when they leave Los Angeles, they don't go back to Hong Kong or Singapore. They go up to Japan, down the coast of China, and back around then to Hong Kong and Singapore. So it's a big loop. And that loop takes several weeks, which means that to provide a regular weekly service, we've got to have that number of vessels. So let's look at one of the individual vessels. Here's the Georg Maersk on the Trans-Pacific 6 route. As you can see, Georg last called Los Angeles on April 30th. Was in Los Angeles for just a few days, 3 days, to load and unload, and then went to Japan, China, Hong Kong, back down to Tanjung Pelepas, which is Singapore, and then actually goes through the Suez Canal to Spain, around the Mediterranean, and then all the way back to Los Angeles. And that whole trip takes about 14 weeks, so there are actually 14 vessels on this, what we call, string of ships. So, of course, having that many vessels out there does have a significant impact on the environment, but we are actually working both as a company and within the industry to try to do something about it. The vessels are becoming more energy efficient, so they're reducing emissions, and this is due to technologies, operations, the speeds we operate at, and the vessel sizes, because there definitely are economies of scale. As you can see by the chart there on the slide, since 2002, we've reduced our CO2 emissions per container per kilometer by 20%, and we've set a goal to reduce an additional 25% by 2020. Reducing the amount of fuel that you burn reduces CO2. It also reduces these other emissions. For example, NOx emissions are also down. And I know that's something that is of concern to all of you who are involved in transportation planning, because we have many areas around the country, particularly port areas, that are in non-attainment status. There's also a large and increasing number of vessels that were built after the year 2000, and so they're certified to the International Maritime Organization NOx standards. And there are new standards coming in for both fuels and NOx performance for the big vessels. And those are set internationally. Now, we've been doing fuel switching on the West Coast for 4 years now. It's over 1,600 port calls since March of 2006. That fuel switching to a distillate fuel instead of that heavy fuel oil actually reduces our sulfur oxide emissions by 95%, our particulate matter emissions by 86%, and NOx emissions between 6 and 12%, depending on the vessel mix. So in California, we did that voluntarily for about 3 years. It has now become mandatory in California. We're doing it also at dock in Washington and British Columbia. We've, since the first week of August, been doing it in Houston, and we started the first week of September in Hong Kong. So fuel switching is a means that companies can take to dramatically improve our criteria pollutants, air emissions. It doesn't do a whole lot for carbon dioxide. So let's look at some of the other things we're doing to reduce the carbon dioxide emissions. One thing is that operational decisions do have a huge impact. So the fuel use and fuel costs actually increase exponentially at higher speeds. So just like cars and trucks get better mileage at lower speeds, so do vessels. For us, it's a lot lower than the cars and trucks. As you can see there, the curve gets fairly steep above about 15 knots. So speeding up uses more fuel than is saved by slowing down. If we speed up by 2 knots, say from 22 to 24 knots, we use an extra 60 metric tons. Whereas if we slow down by 2 knots, we only save 40 metric tons. So the lowest constant speed is best. Speeding up and slowing down to meet different speed limits in different areas actually can cause increases in greenhouse gas emissions and fuel use. And if you want to look at an optimal point, the lowest fuel use and lowest cost is probably around 14 or 15 knots. But that's literally 16 miles an hour. So we're talking about something that's even slower than some of the fast sailing ships of 100 years ago. Now, to enact something like that, which we've been doing, you actually have to redesign the routes. You can't just take your foot off the accelerator. Because remember, we're trying to make those weekly calls. Every Tuesday, the ship leaves Hong Kong, and every Sunday afternoon, a ship pulls into Los Angeles. So here are two schedules. A typical 2007 schedule on the left with 12 vessels shows a fuel consumption of 12,000 metric tons. A new economical speed where we've added actually a 13th vessel so that we can slow down the whole string would use about 10,000 metric tons for the entire group of vessels. So that's a 16% savings on fuel. It reduces costs and emissions of CO2 and the criteria pollutants. So this is something we've now enacted on about half of the containers that we ship. Again, it wasn't just a matter of taking the foot off the accelerator. We actually worked with the engine manufacturers because the manufacturers were recommending an engine load of 40 to 60%. So we started a study working with Wärtsilä and MAN and B&W in 2007 that covered 110 different vessels. And that study showed that it was actually okay long-term to operate even down as far as 10% engine load, which is about half speed. Because remember, the water carries a lot of our weight. So 10% engine load is roughly half speed, but it is a much lower emitting range to operate in. By doing that, we've actually increased our voyage flexibility and schedule planning and increased our schedule reliability, because schedule reliability is probably the number one most important criterion for customers. They want to know that they will get their freight on time. But we're able to meet those dates with higher reliability and still save between 10 and 30% fuel and reduce CO2 emissions by 10 to 30% and criteria pollutants. So there's also a significant cost savings for this. And that does help pay for some of the other projects that we're working on that are not free. For this particular initiative and some of the other things that we're doing, we were selected the 2009 Sustainable Shipping Operator of the Year. Sometimes you also have to retune the engines to get them to optimize out at a slightly lower speed level. And so that's been done on many of our vessels. Technical innovation is also essential for sustainability. It goes from things like an ISO 14001 environmental management system and crew training and engagement, which, by the way, has had some really good effects, all the way up to some really more exotic things, microbubbles forced out through tiny holes on the hull that reduce the drag, or ballast water optimization and treatment system, alternative fuels. So we're looking at all kinds of other things and are implementing them on our vessels, some with retrofit and some have to be put in when we build a new vessel, like the waste heat recovery system. Now let's talk a little bit more about those supply chains. Ocean shipping is the most energy efficient mode of transportation, and of course it also doesn't clog the highways. It doesn't contribute to highway congestion. Let's take one pair of shoes that's being shipped from China to Northern Europe, of course, in a big container with lots of other pairs of shoes. And if you actually divide it out to see what is that pair of shoes' contribution in greenhouse gases, it's about 372 grams of CO2 per pair of shoes. Now, a gram is about the weight of a paperclip. But then what happens when that consumer in London buys those shoes and drives them home just 12 miles from the store? They generate 10 times as much CO2, or 3,700 grams of CO2. I might mention, by the way, that is, of course, unless you buy more pairs of shoes each time you go to the store, which is what I tell my husband anyway. But that's true of our businesses, too. With better planning of routes and combining trips, we can all reduce our carbon footprints without necessarily impeding our businesses. So shipping emits around 4% of the world's man-made CO2 emissions while transporting 90% of the world's goods. And here's how the different modes of transportation stack up. As you can see, ocean shipping is the most energy efficient down there at the bottom of the chart, followed by rail that's electric or diesel. Trucking is about 5 times less efficient. And then air freight, of course, is the most inefficient way because you have to stay in the air as well as move the goods forward. So ocean shipping is the most energy effective way to move freight. Well, let's see what that translates into. Well, here are the factors determining supply chain carbon footprints, and we've been working closely with an industry association and with customers to determine how we can do these things effectively. First is the mode of transportation, and the energy efficiency of that mode and the routing available, because it doesn't help if you're more energy efficient if you have to go 5 times as far to make the trip. Then there's the distance traveled by each mode, the cargo or container weight and volume, and then how you actually calculate and measure these things and report it. The World Resources Institute does have a distance-based protocol for calculating supply chain carbon footprint. There are also softwares that are out there for doing these calculations, and there are carrier-specific tools like Carbon Check and Carbon Dashboard, which are some of the tools that are available within my own company and others from other carriers. The The Clean Cargo Working Group is the industry group that I mentioned that has added definition and collects data for the vessel side of it. And there are other groups that focus on other modes, like Smartway that focuses on trucking transportation. Here's the Clean Cargo Working Group. We've been in existence since about 2001, and we've actually been collecting data since 2004. And that data is put in the form of emissions factors to enable our shipper members and the liner companies to actually do these carbon calculations in a consistent manner so that trade routes can be compared. We also do an annual benchmarking of the member line's environmental performance, and that really has resulted in increased energy in reducing our environmental footprint, increased motivation to do that. We also have an intermodal calculator that allows us a consistent way of calculating these things. And I might mention, by the way, that the website to get more information about Clean Cargo is up there just under the title. Clean Cargo does put out an environmental performance scorecard. This is the simplified version of it. This is the summary sheet. As you can see, we look at carbon dioxide emissions as well as some of the criteria pollutants. And other factors like environmental management systems, transparency. We also look at chemicals used and that kind of thing. And then down at the bottom, you'll see that we have actually a detailed carbon performance factor for each trade lane. And this actually goes down quite a ways so that for every trade lane between, say, Asia and North Europe, Asia and North America, for both dry containers and refrigerated containers, there is a defined emissions factor for CO2 that is based on actual data. And these things are updated every year by Clean Cargo. Now, when we put that into practice, let's make a comparison of shipping a container of, say, sporting apparel from Istanbul to Belgium. If you go across Europe by truck, you generate about 1,300 kilograms of CO2. However, if you go by truck to the port, put it onto a ship, go all the way out through Gibraltar and around through to the port in Belgium, and then drive it to the distribution center that way, you only generate 980 kilograms of CO2. So as the bar chart on the left shows, when you add up all the pieces, you can actually reduce the carbon footprint of this total chain by about 21%. It also does, by the way, increase the time required to get it there. As I mentioned, we do have internal tools. This is a slide that I show courtesy of Nike and our sister company, which is Damco, the Maersk Logistics Company. They did a case study on some work that both Maersk Line and Damco did with Nike to try to optimize their carbon footprint and reduce it. And this visibility on the supply chain carbon footprint has really helped Nike accomplish their goal of 30% reduction for 2020. They, by shifting some things, for example, from air freight to ocean, were able to reduce their carbon footprint 12% last year. And there's a complete case study on that posted on the Damco website, which you can see in miniature but probably can't read there on the right side. This is extracted from another one of those case studies at Damco.com. Several projects with Boots, which is a leading pharmaceutical and health and beauty store retailer in the UK. Since 2004, work with these analyses enabled Boots to reduce their CO2 emissions by 29% and reduce their logistics costs by 21%. So it's a win-win proposition if you do it right. So let me just summarize then what we've learned through this process. First of all, it's really important to use a consistent calculator approach, and it's best if it's agreed upon by the whole industry. Clean Cargo Working Group is the group that's working with the ocean industry. Of course, Smartway does trucks. There are groups in Europe like Ecotransit and NTM that also have similar data collection processes. so that you're working with real data. Transportation footprints can and have been reduced. But we have to keep in mind that it's the total life cycle footprint that matters. Transportation is often only a small part of the total. I've seen numbers anywhere from 5% to 25% or higher for the total supply chain footprint that's related to the transportation. So near sourcing doesn't necessarily always make the greatest amount of sense. You have to do the full analysis to really see the big picture. But if you focus on improvements and actually incorporate the carbon impact into business decisions, you can actually make real progress on both and perhaps also improve your business. The opportunity is to reduce both CO2 emissions and costs. And my contact information is provided here on the last slide. And I'll turn it back over to you, Jennifer.
Well, thank you, Lee, and thank you to those of you who posted questions. We will get to the questions after the other presentations. I'm now going to turn it over to Mike Zachary of Parsons Brinckerhoff.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer, and thank you, Lee. I think the key point that Lee had was in her last slide that said that there needs to be a systematic approach. I'm going to be talking to you today about some of the shipper's responsibilities and the nodes along the lines that the shipper has to address. They're not just in it for social responsibility. They're basically in it because they have to have an efficient supply chain that makes money. So as Lee mentioned, and as Diego's definitely going to mention, you know, why do we need to look at this? We need to reduce 80% of our total emissions. Trucking, as Lee pointed out, under air is probably the worst, and especially if you do it on a per container or per ton basis. And so the bottom point there is the supply chain, all the nodes, all the modal components of the supply chain want to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. And so when we take a look at what is that, and Lee, thank you for mentioning that, right now, it's interesting because in January's TRB conference, they indicated that freight was 28% of transportation's 28%, which you see that number now has gone up, according to some recent studies, 29%. And you can see where light-duty vehicles and freight trucks and aircraft fall into that. One of the problems that we have and are going to continue to have is defining freight. For instance, is UPS, DHL, FedEx package delivery, is that considered freight, or is freight only in the 18-wheelers going to and from a distribution center or a store? And so part of that is, as Lee mentioned, the measurement component of that, and what does that mean? So how can freight be reduced? And this is on all aspects of it. Lee's touched on this a lot, so I won't go into it, but I think that the two bottom points is where the logistics service providers, of which ocean carriers, and we mentioned Damco, you know, a lot of 3PLs are getting involved in it, definitely the shippers' responsibilities, in terms of looking at what the distribution networks are, looking at, you know, if you're looking at a complete systems approach, how much reverse haul, empty backhaul is considered as part of that, what are my modal options? Great display on the Europe trucking versus ocean. Do we use double stack trains? How can we eliminate truck bottlenecks? I know Houston and Dallas are both working on truck bypass routes to get them out of the congested areas, adding more miles, but they're able to travel at a more efficient speed. So when we take a look at from an MPO, Metropolitan Planning Organization's planning perspective, or a state DOT's planning perspective, I think in all the goods movement studies that we're doing, we're currently involved in six different ones, an understanding of the supply chain is absolutely critical. What's the routing? Why are shippers using that mode or that node in the supply chain? Why are they going through downtown Houston? As Lee mentioned, models to analyze the global greenhouse gas effect in terms of what each mode, each node contributes to that. And then how do you analyze, well, you take that measurement, and what do you do to infrastructure and policy improvements? And I'm not going to start talking about a need for policy. And there's you will hear me mention several times, we do not have adequate standards. We are not playing on the same level playing field. And we, in the United States, definitely need a federal freight strategy. So if you take different views of the emission producers, you have the supply chain, which is the prerogative of the shippers. You have the different transportation modes, the carriers. You have the effect of the regions, the ports, the state DOTs. And probably more importantly, we have to play in a global playing field. And right now, we're off playing left field in a ballpark that the rest of the world is playing in. And that's one of the key issues that I have with a lot of the issues that we're dealing with. So from a shipper, BCO, beneficial cargo owner's perspective, what are they looking at in a supply chain? You know, I'm just going to pick on Lee again because she hit on all these points, but from an ocean carrier's perspective, but from a total systems perspective, I have to have reliability. As Lee mentioned, you know, she has 14 vessels for a 14-week deployment. That means a weekly call. If one of those weekly calls gets delayed a week, the entire supply chain gets screwed up. So I have to be reliable. I have to have efficiency of cost. I have to have density and balanced cargo. What does that mean? Well, on a rail, on an intermodal rail train, that means I got to have a full train that leaves, and it's nice to have the same amount of containers coming back full that I shipped out. So my east and westbound movements should be balanced, and not necessarily with empties. I'm looking for redundant and contingent supply chains. Katrina brought up a huge effort where the, you know, the Gulf ports were closed down. And if that was my only supply chain entry into the United States, I was not a happy camper. So a lot of shippers now are looking at redundant ports, and the Panama Canal plays into this. And finally, what social responsibility can I afford? Everybody has said they want to play in the game. They want to be socially responsible. But is it going to cost me anything? And again, one of the questions that came up is BCO is beneficial cargo owner. Okay, supply chains. Why focus on supply chains? Well, that's the way we work. Decisions are made in global, in multiple jurisdictions on sourcing, manufacturing, assembly. Lee mentioned the complex life cycle of production, transportation, consumption. Definitely global. What you're going to hear today, time and time again, and Diego's going to say it, is the supply chain is ever changing. The sourcing and the distribution patterns kind of go by the will of the winds, and most importantly, by the components of cost that we get into it. And a lot of that cost is directly applicable to the legislative, either policy or rule. Mitigations that come about in terms of air quality attainment and cap and trade, and I'll talk specifically a little more about cap and trade. So you've got these three bubbles that all interplay with each other and all affect each other. Now let's take a look at some of them. A good example. We say there's no such thing as acting locally in terms of just some of the commodities. This just came off a recent study that we are doing. And for instance, if you take a look at U.S. apparel import value and market share, these are the different countries that we're getting apparels from. And if you look back in the late 1990s, Mexico was the leading importer. Now China is. Indonesia is coming up. Vietnam's coming up. India is coming up. So this gives a good indication that stuff is changing. And the source is changing, and if you're going to look at the component from a shipper's perspective, and I'm looking at the entire supply chain, that has an impact on it. The next impact is, without naming names, a large shipper built a large distribution facility in the Houston market, and it came online, guess what, about 2004. And you can see that because of that, there was a significant increase in the amount of furniture that came into the Houston area. Thus, that was the gateway into the United States. Whereas the apparel component really didn't change that much. So again, a decision by a major shipper or distributor, logistics service provider, does have an impact on terms from an MPO's perspective in terms of what cargo they're going to see. You're also going to see some changes with the Panama Canal expansion. We're involved with Barrett and a couple of other agencies looking at the effect of the Panama Canal and where cargo is going to flow and how it's going to flow and the impact that it's going to have on all U.S. ports, West Coast, Gulf Coast, and East Coast. The Heartland Corridor, the Crescent Corridor, you know, the new corridors that the Eastern Railroads are now developing to handle containerized cargo is significantly changing the landscape. Quite frankly, the intermodal mentality of Western Railroads is now starting to be applied to the Eastern Railroads. And that's not a dig, that's just the fact that they haven't had to produce an intermodal train. Let me give you an example. In a recent study, it wasn't part of my bio, but I used to be the director of port planning for the Port of Tacoma for 5 years. When we had a vessel call and we cranked out a ship, we cranked out three full unit trains of intermodal cargo from one terminal, from one vessel call. You get down into Charleston, Savannah, some of the Gulf Coast ports, they will crank out one train a week. That's not density. And some of those trains then go and get reassembled in Atlanta. So what the railroads are looking for and what the ports and the steamship companies are looking for is the economy of scale and the density by cranking out a unit train a day. And again, it goes back to some of Lee's point in terms of the efficiency of that mode. So again, what are some of the factors that affect the shipper's decision criteria? Obviously cost, the reliability that we talked about, the density, but more importantly, it's the uniform applicability and enforcement policies. We'll talk about some of the differences in those policies. So if I have the alternative, as Lee mentioned, in terms of routing, and this is a good example, you know, I can go, if I'm going to the Houston-Dallas area, I can go all water 24 days. I can go intermodal through the Southern California ports. It takes me 20 days. So I lose 4 days of time, but I may save on my carbon emissions. I may save on costs. And so, again, do I divide up my supply chain to have the redundancy and call both ports, or do I put a lot of product in one port, in one distribution chain? Let's switch over from the BCO perspective to the MPO perspective and this new phenomenon that's coming about in terms of mega regions and how mega regions handle it. Just as a highlight right now, currently 66% of all international trade is handled within a mega region. And 77% of all domestic trade within the mega regions are moved by truck. 77% of all the domestic trade moved by truck occurs in the mega regions. 60% of that effort is within the mega regions, and 4% is by rail. The second bullet is the key aspect of it. There's going to be a tremendous amount of imports as the mega regions continue to grow. So by 2035, there's going to be an 85% increase in the mega regions for export goods, and 76% for import goods within the mega regions. And like I said, we're working for several of those mega regions MPOs, and there is no national policy, there is no standards as to how a shipper can plan on a supply chain using or going through or locating distribution, manufacturing, assembly facilities within that mega region. And not to pick on the Port of LA Long Beach, but here's a good example. Southern California ports have put together a truck licensing program. I applaud it. It's a great program, but it's going to add cost. And the shipper has to make a decision whether that cost to go through LA Long Beach is part of their social responsibility, or can I save a couple hundred bucks and go through Houston or go through Seattle, Tacoma? That's the point, because the rest of the ports on the West Coast and the Gulf Coast are not following suit to what LA Long Beach is doing. They're looking at it, but right now that's not a level playing field. So when you take a look at the current federal climate policies, obviously we have a whole bunch of different forms. We got the cap and trade, we got a whole bunch of energy bills. You're going to hear me and the other speakers talk about the transportation reauthorization and what strings come attached with that. You have all these different regulations and guidance, all of which have the form of affecting trade in the region. Specifically, the U.S. cap and trade legislation, right now it doesn't do much, quite frankly, for the shipper, because the shipper is looking at the entire supply chain. And the bottom point down there is the key. Right now, the cap and trade in the United States is focused on a point source. It's focused on the utility, the manufacturing facility, the fossil fuel plant. If cap and trade can be made to be more global along the supply chain, then you're going to get a lot more information and a lot more participation by the supply chain participant. Let me give you an example. If I'm shipper X and I use a Maersk vessel, which is and my manufacturing facility is in China and it's in a debit situation, but because I'm using Maersk's new efficient cargo vessels and with slow steaming, I get a credit. I come through the port of Seattle, which is a green port, and I go through the SSA terminal at T18, and both of those are green, so I get credit from the port and I get credit from the terminal, and I use the BNSF's green locomotives, and I get credit from the railroad component of it, and I get it to Chicago and I truck it to Indianapolis. I may be back into a debit, but the overall supply chain may in fact have a total credit to it. Now, what I do with those credits is up to me as a shipper, but the point of it is that the entire supply chain may be green, whereas the components of different components of it may not be. So what's the status of the cap and trade? House passed it, Senate hasn't. There's been several amendments to it, but the current guess is that it's not going to go anywhere this year. There's going to be more on different energy bills, and does not match the EU policy, which is very much trying to get to the supply chain component of it. So what are the proposed binary requirements that are kind of in all these different bills and legislations? Well, we got all sorts of different targets and strategies. None of them are the same. They're all saying that the states and large MPOs must demonstrate progress without any kind of guidance. There's a whole bunch of different methodologies without standardized models, without the different methodologies, and without uniform data collection, and quite frankly, without some of the definitions of terms of what we're looking at. USDOT is not certifying the state or the MPO plans, and everybody's looking for the USDOT to establish some of the requirements and the performance measures in terms of how they are met and what happens if they're not met. And again, all that ties into, again, right now, specifically the reauthorization bill in terms of how projects and mega projects are going to be viewed. So the bottom line is we have some issues. Planning is impacted by the state and federal policies. That affects the DOTs, the MPOs, it affects the shippers, it affects the carriers. We need the ability to predict. Thank you again, Lee, with your clean cargo working group. I know we have an internal model that we're using use with our shippers and MPOs to predict the effect of the supply chain, but we're using known and current data. The legislation can change that data at any time. So what's the summary? There's a lot of stuff happening out there. I don't need to go into all this stuff. And we need the data collection. We need the modeling. We need a federal freight strategy that makes it uniform. what are the, there's 33 states that have done state climate plans to date. Unfortunately, they're focused on major sectors, the electricity building, like I said, the point source. They're based on these wildly changing targets. They've been conducted literally on shoestring budgets in a limited time frame with a lot of cookbook approach. This is what XYZ did it, so I'm going to follow their lead and do it separately. The carriers, the shippers have been excluded up to this point in time. And so a major decision criteria as to locating a new distribution or a new manufacturing facility will have an impact on a lot of these plans, and that's not being looked at the current time. And again, bottom line, some of them have been adopted, others are just reports. I wanted to bring up real quick what Canada is doing. Canada, quite frankly, has developed a national strategy for goods movement. It's called the Asia-Pacific Gateway Strategy, and on the East Coast, they have an Atlantic Gateway Strategy. And this is from their vision statement, a framework for policies, investments, and initiatives that seek to make Canada the most competitive exit and entry point in North America. There was a recent op-ed in the Seattle Times written by the Washington State Department of Transportation Secretary Paul Hammond, John Wolfe, who's the executive director of the Port of Tacoma, that basically says we can't compete. We in the Northwest cannot compete with Prince Rupert and Port of Vancouver, British Columbia, and Canada, because Canada is using this national strategy. So everything that happens looks at the policies, the investments, and the initiatives that make Canadian supply chains stronger. If that continues, Port Tacoma, Port of Seattle, and the Northwest ports, and all the West Coast ports are going to feel an impact on that movement. So the bottom line, folks, freight pays our bills. If everybody would take a close look at the label on most of everybody's clothing that they're wearing, it's not made in the United States. And so consumerism is rampant. We got to build up the economy. Thank you, Lee, for buying more than a dozen pairs of shoes in one trip to the store. But we need to realize that freight is a significant economic driver in a region, a state, and a national level. Manufacturers, shippers, distributors, they're changing their sourcing criteria. That sourcing makes the supply chains very, very dynamic. Everybody wants to green the supply chain. The shipper must realize a direct economic and operational benefit and must get rewarded for it. Hence, that's why I'm proposing or looking at the cap and trade that is supply chain of interest. And the bottom line is we absolutely need some sort of standardized freight policy that addresses the greenhouse gas emissions, GHG emission, and creates some standards for that. So with that, Jennifer, I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you, Mike. We're now going to turn it over to our final presenter, Diego Clavion of Northwestern University. Diego, you can begin.
Thank you, Jennifer. So I'll talk about carbon footprint needs in logistics, and I'll give a slightly different perspective. So I'll mostly focus on carbon footprint accounting in logistics and the actual allocation of carbon footprint. So I'll raise the issues later. So in the last year or so, I spoke with many shippers and carriers, and my main interest was essentially in trying to learn what is the today's status in the U.S. when it comes to the actual carbon footprint accounting logistics, or we can guess it broadly, sort of in supply chain management. And so here is, you know, the good and the bad. So first, you know, why do shippers or companies in general today care about carbon footprint accounting? So there are some that do it for the sake of having, you know, a green image. But in most of the companies, green image, you know, doesn't add a lot of value, so they actually look at economical benefits. And if you know what is your carbon footprint, then you know it's something that you can measure, which means you can also manage, right? So if you don't know what is your companies, and they actually use innovative approaches to both reduce carbon footprint as well as reduce costs. And then, you know, some of the companies will be doing it or are already doing it just for the sake of, you know, potential future mandates, and not so much, you know, at now because there's so much uncertainty about government policies. They do it mostly because of fear of mandates from, you know, from big guys. In this case, for example, Walmart announced that in 2015, roughly, they want to start, you know, putting eco labels on goods that they sell. And in the UK, for example, Tesco, for example, is already experimenting this in some of their products. You know, they put an eco-friendly label, and customers can actually compare various products. So about a year ago, for example, a lot of the logistics service providers, they did not have many requests from their customers, which are in this case shippers, with questions about carbon footprint. So how much is my carbon footprint? But in the last year, I've heard from couple of logistics service providers that has changed. So in other words, they're getting many, many more requests. So essentially from a handful of carbon footprint requests about a year ago to today, where they have sort of more than 100 such requests. Another service provider also pushed it, you know, to the limit, in a sense that they're actually providing carbon footprint for every single shipper that they handle, right, or that they manage. So now these are kind of, you know, the good side of the story, because, you know, there is definitely, it's increasing. So from, you know, a handful of requests now to over 100 requests. But on the other hand, there are still plenty of less than truckload operators that do not provide such a service. And I mean, by such a service, I mean, they do not provide the carbon footprint of their customers, or in other words, shippers. Some of them are saying, well, we don't get too many requests. And clearly they don't yet view this as a competitive advantage, even though, you know, in a few years sort of it might be, but now they don't see such a potential competitive advantage. Now, many shippers, you know, they are not willing to trade cost for, quote, you know, what I call here eco image. Okay? So if a carrier is more eco-friendly but more expensive, well, most of them will go for the cheaper carriers. No, really no surprise there. But it is the case that many shippers now, if cost being equal, when they evaluate two carriers, for example, cost being equal, well, they will actually start to look at green, say, initiatives of the two carriers, and then, you know, they will take that into account when they actually make a decision. The situation is different in European Union because of the regulations that require you to essentially trade off cost and emissions. So an example that I want to bring up here is Procter & Gamble, where in Western Europe, for example, just to lower their emissions, they switched, or they are switching, from trucking to rail. And I'm not, by no means I'm saying all of their transportation or logistics services, but they want to, the portion of rail, you know, used to be 10% of all their shipments. Now they want to push that to 30%, and the main reason being reducing the carbon footprint. They have an awesome, in my opinion, initiative in Brazil, where instead of shipping grains, you know, from the Amazon basin down with trucks to ports in the south of Brazil, they now actually use ships on the Amazon River, and then from the Amazon River, so they ship directly to the U.S. Now, they do have a 40% longer lead time, you know, because they essentially moved from trucking to vessel from the Amazon River, but they concluded that they lowered their emissions by 60%. So there's clearly, you know, a trade-off there. Both Lee and Mike mentioned Smartway on a few occasions. I want to say, you know, I'm not affiliated at all with Smartway, but I am interacting with Smartway, had, you know, several discussions discussions with them. So let me just briefly say a little bit more about SmartWay, really, you know, in a few sentences, for those of you that are not aware what SmartWay is. So SmartWay is a program within EPA that is supposed to bring together such companies and shippers and say and help them in reducing their carbon their emissions in transportation. So the participation within SmartWay is completely free, so every company can join, and it's open to any company. So trucking companies who join and actually receive SmartWay certification, they essentially commit to improve their fuel efficiency and to reduce emissions. And shippers that are part of SmartWay, essentially they commit to use SmartWay tracking partners, or in other words, SmartWay certified carriers. But this doesn't, by no means, this means that all of their shipments must be with SmartWay certified carriers. It's just, you know, a certain portion of their shipments. And SmartWay also helps them in improving their freight operations that then eventually lead to reduced emissions. So SmartWay has a tool called the Fleet Model, Freight Logistics Environmental and Energy Tracking Performance Model, where, you know, shippers, for example, enter all of their shipments within the last year, for example, and carriers that they use, and then they get, the tool then gives you or calculates the NOx, CO2 emissions, and PM, particulate matter, you know, contributions. And so carriers use this tool mostly to, for example, get a sense of what their potential strategies, such as, you know, if they change their fleet composition, for example, how they're going to affect the carbon footprint of that particular carrier. So it conducts or they conduct, you know, a what if type analysis with fleet, and also it gives them a strategic guidance. And so shippers likewise, you know, use the tool to get their carbon footprint from all of the logistics operations within, for example, the past year. So essentially, you know, it's a tool to measure their environmental footprint. So this is just a very quick summary of SmartWay, essentially, you know, with the focus on fleet. Now, when I talk to the shippers and carriers about carbon footprint accounting in logistics, it was clear that there are many, many challenges. Some of them are what I would call, you know, the traditional, old-fashioned challenges when it comes to data. So when you want to calculate your carbon footprint emissions from logistics, you need to have all sorts of logistics-related data, and then there are issues when it comes to collecting the data, transparency, quality of data, etc. So all of the, you know, standard data-related issues. Now, a much bigger hurdle, at least now, are the actual processes, because most of the shippers don't have processes in place. So essentially what ends up happening is that they have to, you know, manually pick up the phone, call carriers, call their logistics service providers to get, you know, the quantities that they want, so that they are then able to calculate carbon footprint. Another, you know, this is sort of a minor point, but nevertheless, it was raised by quite a few of them. So I just mentioned the fleet model. So SmartWay is about to release a new version of the fleet model, and some of them are really concerned about the impact to their carbon footprint reporting, because the fleet model, it gives you a score, how much, quote, you know, green you are, and now they are worried whether, you know, they will increase that score, or it's going to actually, or the score will actually be reduced. So here's a typical example that a fairly large global shipper had to go through in order to get their carbon footprint from logistics. So this shipper in the U.S. So this is just a situation in the U.S. was tasked to calculate carbon footprint emissions for their logistics operations in the U.S. And you see here that they have many divisions. Every division, you know, has is using its own transportation service provider. They have, you know, from they use from parcel carriers to shippers to freight audit and payment providers. You know, there are kind of middlemen, say, between the actual carriers and the shippers. So it was really for them the first year. It was a very tedious task because, you know, there were no processes in place. There wasn't a single data source that they could just simply grab all the data from. They had to, you know, make many calls within the company, many calls outside of the company to put all of the data in place. And then, you know, then there's standard, you know, data issues. Missing data, missing weight, for example. You know, if the weight is missing, you assume that it's zero. Well, then you are distorting your true emissions. Then if you go down to aggregation bias, for example, where, you know, you ship, say, on the first day of the month, you ship 10 pounds, not 10, okay, so let's say 200 pounds, and then a week later, with a different mode of transportation, sort of, you ship 50 pounds now, because you don't know really details about this mode, you just consolidate the two numbers together, and you make certain assumptions. So there's a lot of uncertainty. And assumptions that one needs to make when it comes to that. So when I was trying to think about this carbon footprint accounting issues, I came up with a very fundamental you know, issue that if you look at just full truckloads where, you know, you have single dedicated truck going from A to B, then to calculate carbon footprint of that particular transportation move, it's very simple, right? Because you know, for example, suppose you know the fuel consumption of the truck, you can calculate that fairly precisely. But the situation becomes much more difficult if you switch over to less than truckloads, where you have one truck carrying goods from several shippers, and now you can calculate the emissions of the entire truck, but it becomes much more challenging than how do you allocate those emissions to the various shippers. Now, you can, for example, split by weight, you can split by volume, or, you know, any other means, but, you know, in either case, you can come up with situations that where you will, you know, put more bias on one shipper versus another shipper. I also spoke with two parcel carriers that are, you know, direct competitors, and I asked them, you know, all right, so you ship this, you know, small packages and parcels, and somebody asks you, all right, what's the carbon footprint of this particular shipment? That, you know, for example, it went from Peoria to Fresno, California, you know, it went from Peoria to Chicago, then to Memphis, to the hub, and then flew over to Oakland, and from Oakland to Fresno. You know, every one of them is using a different way to allocate emissions. So there's no real standard guidance or say, collaboration between the two of them. Now, the situation is, you know, when it comes to the, I mentioned already, carbon footprint accounting and allocation, if you really think about less than truckload carriers that operate on so-called, you know, relay points, so they have relay points where they actually consolidate goods, and then they, you know, use bigger trucks to truck the load from one consolidation port to, point to another consolidation point. At a system level, yeah, I mean, it's relatively simple to calculate emissions, but then when you need to allocate all those emissions to the various users of the system, it becomes much more challenging. So SmartWay's perspective is really it's an excellent starting point, but we have to keep in mind that SmartWay's perspective is really at a macro level. So in other words, you know, they look at all the shipments in 1 year, you know. There are no details as to, you know, what vehicle or what mode was actually used. Well, they actually focus on trucking, okay, but let's say what vehicle was actually used. And it's a perfect tool for a static environment where, for example, you know, every day you ship the same quantity. bigger challenge as to how do you actually allocate your emissions. So a more micro level view, you know, might give a different picture of emissions in terms of allocation, okay? Because again, at a system level, you know, allocations are what they are. So these are just, you know, a summary of the main challenges that I have identified. So on the data side, you know, it's same old story. And then on the allocation schemas, for example, another issue is when you have backhauls, you know, where trucks are actually moving empty. Well, you know, shippers are responsible for those for emissions from backhauls. So how do you, you know, how do you allocate them to shippers? And then it becomes even more challenging if you think about intermodal freight. So if someone, you know, ships a container from, say, Beijing to I don't know, let's say Memphis, when it goes through several modes of transportation, you know, it becomes much more challenging, for example, how to allocate the actual emissions. And all this thinking about allocation actually then drew me to a slightly different perspective, which is more on the national level in the following sense. So it's, you know, we've seen today, Mike already showed a slide that presented the actual breakdown of emissions at the national level. So I think Mike's slide was more recent than mine, but in 2008, transportation accounted for 33.1% of total U.S. emissions. Now, the question then becomes, if you want to drill down to this 33%, to this 33.1%, how much of that is used by rails, by maritime transportation, by trucking, ports? And then it becomes really challenging, sort of, if you start asking questions, all right, what's the emission contribution of intermodal yards or terminals? What's the contribution of drayage, for example, right? So it's, you know, one can get, for example, the air emissions at a national level relatively, you know, easily, but then if you want to really, you know, slice it and dice it, and you start asking questions, you know, drayage, you know, intermodal yards, rail transportation, anything, what are the actual emission contributions at a regional level, at a state level, corridor level, different industry, different operation, you know, drayage, for example, I think it becomes much more challenging to actually get carbon footprint contributions when you start to, you know, slice it and dice it and asking questions about or at a much more fine granular level. Now, why is that? Why are this kind of questions important? Well, they could assist decision makers and policy makers into making better decisions. And mostly, you know, this kind of information will complement the typical cost decisions by providing also the emission, say, counterpart. Okay, so decision makers will not just have complete cost picture at the corridor level, but they will also have an emission picture at the same corridor level. And then, you know, that can then help in making infrastructure decisions that are not 100% driven by cost, but also take into account the emission side of the picture. Another, you know, Mike talked extensively about cap and trade. You know, for example, suppose, you know, you want to actually impose caps on emissions for a particular mode or in a particular region, in a particular corridor, etc. I know that TRV, for example, initiated a study or put a RFP there for, you know, possible, and the stress here is on the word possible, okay, on a possible cap and trade for airports, for example. So that will be, you know, all right, so if you want to do cap and trade, what should the cap be? What's a reasonable cap for the entire, over the entire airport? And I want to wrap this up by again raising the issue of, for example, you know, parcel carriers, you know, UPS and FedEx, for example, that, you know, there's no uniform standard as to how to allocate carbon footprint to the various users of the entire system. And I hope I persuaded you that this is not that simple of a question. It is relatively easy to answer the question at a national level, and if you just focus, say, on the entire contribution, but when you try to, you know, break it down to the operations, to the various modes, regions, you know, then it becomes much more intriguing. And with that, thank you very much, and I'll be a little bit peculiar here. You are free to contact me by my email, but you can also text message me. And why, the reason why I'm putting, why I have a text message, you know, which is essentially my phone number, is I have unlimited text messages, but text messaging, but only my kids text message me, nobody else. So I encourage you to text message me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Diego. I believe that is a first that we've had for contact information, text messaging, but I guess it just shows where communications are heading these days.
It shows how old are we.
So,